Production. Recorded live.
Welcome, everybody, to episode 5 of Cloud 259, Running on Air. It's March 28th. Spring has sprung, just a little bit, anyways, here in New York City. My name is Brent Jones. My co-host is Greg Lemelstein. About a month ago, we did our first interview on the show, and tonight we are thrilled to have our first Olympian on the show. So, Greg, why don't you tell us what we've got in store tonight?
Okay, Bren. Yeah, we have today our workout is about the business of running, and we already know it's going to be part one of our of this subject because it's a very interesting and multi-layered subject. But we're very happy to have on Olympian Amy Begley, who will be discussing the business of running with us. We'll then, after the interview, we'll talk about a little bit about the elite scene, which went through Bydgoszcz, Poland just recently and is headed this weekend to Palo Alto. And then we'll take a trip to the library to discuss a classic of running fiction. And then, Bren, you'll round things up with us getting on the soapbox to discuss World Cross and the Olympics. But why don't we just get into the workout, the business of running. We wanted to start things off before we bring on Amy and just talk about some of the, I would say, the weird things that are about the funding model of running or how pro runners, elite runners are funded. And let's get right to it. So weird thing number one is the lack of transparency. There really isn't much details about how runners are compensated. A lot of the compensation of runners is through shoe company contracts, which are private between the runner and runners and the company. And this really contrasts with most other sports where salaries or earnings are widely discussed and benchmarked.
I'd say thing two, and here I feel a little like we're doing some Dr. Seuss thing one and thing two. Thing two is that in running, the losers subsidize the winners, or to put it more gently, the pack subsidizes the front runners, at least when we're talking about road races. In most sports, the spectators buy tickets, and through these ticket purchases, the athletes eventually get paid. There are other contributors, endorsers, but basically the fans pay for the athletes indirectly. When it comes to road racing, though, it's actually the participants in the road races who pay for the athletes' prize money. These races are free to watch, so the spectators don't pay for the athletes, which just sets it apart from just about any other sport.
So weird
thing. I'd add just that one more note to that is that if you look even more obliquely, the participants in these sports are also the ones buying a lot of the running shoes, and that money goes from the companies, the Nikes of the world, back to the pros. Through the contracts with the professional athletes.
Mm-hmm. Weird thing number three, there's a very steep pyramid of earnings among pro runners. And again, there's not a lot of detail because, as I said, there's not much transparency. But there was an article by Jack Wickens of USA Track and Field Foundation that estimated that among the pro runners who are competing from the mile to the 10,000 meters, those ranked in the top five in the U.S. earn anywhere from $60,000 to $500,000 per year. But those ranked from the top six down to the top 20 in the U.S. had incomes below $30,000. And those outside the top 20 had little or no income, basically weren't earning anything. So marathoners fare a little bit better than that by this estimate, but not much. And it's a very similar steep, steep curve.
Weird thing number four, there's no collective bargaining, at least not yet, in running or track and field. In team sports like Major League Baseball, the NFL, the NBA, where collective bargaining has resulted in huge gains for the athletes, the salaries are really astronomical compared to running at any rate. Average NBA salary is above $5 million, baseball is above $3 million, hockey above $2 million, and NFL is about $2 million. Now, in track and field, there are grassroots efforts at unionizing, which we'll discuss a little later, but no collective bargaining at this point.
Weird thing number five, race winnings are surprisingly low. Now, marathons aside, there are some big purses in the marathon majors, of course, but among some of the even the bigger track races, the winnings are lower than one might think. The U.S. Outdoor Championships give $7,000 to each winner, and that's even a big increase from years past. U.S. Indoors, I believe, is about $2,500, which barely covers plane and hotel for the athletes. Although some runners, I think if you're ranked in the top six, you get some subsidies for travel. The winner of a Diamond League race makes $10,000. World champions, and that's world champions, make $40,000 for a win, plus $50,000 for a world record. But obviously, world championships are not easy to obtain.
Okay. And finally, weird thing number six, and this is that there isn't really a league to promote the sport. And for sort of a broad view of this, I will send listeners to the excellent podcast, Marathon Talk, where Tony Rivas talks about this. But basically, in contrast to other sports, track and field is dependent on rulemaking governing bodies like the USATF and the IAAF to organize and promote its events. But there is no PGA Tour or NASCAR circuit to make sure that the athletes get a lot of money. Basically, the USATF doesn't do a great job of making sure that the pro runners get paid. The closest thing would be the Diamond League, which is 14 events in Europe and in the U.S., but even that is coordinated by the IAAF, so there are purses for Diamond League events, but certainly there's no U.S. track circuit that's organized with prize money for the runners, anything comparable to the team sports that we discussed before.
So that's pretty much a synopsis. I think we could come up with other items, but we don't want to delay our interview any further. Amy Begley, we're so happy to have on the show. She is, just briefly, I'll give you some of the amazing career highlights. 2008 Olympian in the 10,000 meters, U.S. indoor champion twice at 10,000 meters, also U.S. champion at 15K and on the roads at 5K and 10K, a 15-time All-American at Arkansas, and two-time NCAA champion. She's in the University of Arkansas Hall of Fame. The list goes on and on. I could give you others, but she's also a coach, and she's looking to form an elite group of women's runners, which we will talk about. Amy Begley, very happy to welcome you to the cloud.
Ah, thank you. And I love the running on air and workout for today. I love that.
Yeah, well, thanks very much. We just want to get to some of the issues. The thing I also should have mentioned is that you've been writing a bit about this subject, and it seems to me that from my reading that you are doing at least two things. One, bringing more transparency to the sport and perhaps helping young runners who are considering post-collegiate careers, becoming elite runners themselves, and helping them know what they're getting into, some of the pitfalls, but also working to maybe change the system around the margins and seeing where we can make things more productive for runners. So first off, can you discuss the difficulty of getting funding for pro runners or aspiring pros, and are shoe contracts the primary source of income? And if so, what are the pitfalls of that?
Well, I've been saying all along that the shoe companies should not have to prop up our sport. We shouldn't just have one source of income, which we do. Distance runners, we actually have it lucky compared to the rest of track and field. If you talk to field events, especially throws, their lives and money from track and field is really minuscule. But, yeah, shoe contracts are pretty much the only source of funding unless you're in a group, but most groups are funded by shoe companies, in the end. And the pitfalls of that are, you are a contracted employee, so there's no benefits. They don't take out taxes, so you need to be able to do that. And, for a young 20-year-old coming out of college, sometimes, that's not always the easiest thing for them to figure out. And then your contract, sometimes they'll sign you for 1 year, sometimes they'll sign you to 4 years. And the bonuses and rollovers are great if you're running well. But if you get injured or you're pregnant or anything along that line that keeps you from training or competing for anywhere from 3 to 6 months, they'll either suspend you and not pay you the next 6 months that you didn't, the next 6 months that you are competing to make up for it, or they'll cut you, or they'll reduce you at the end of the year. The problem with those are, for a long time, when the economy was really good, they didn't always do those reductions. They didn't always take things like that because they were trying to be nice, they were trying to help you with your career, and they only really used those on people that they didn't like and wanted to get rid of. And so when athletes were negotiating probably in the last 5 or 6 years, the contracts were pretty much just cut and dry. This is the contract, and you'd say, oh, but what about this reduction and this reduction? And they'd say, oh, you know, we don't take those, we don't do those. Well, then the economy got worse, and yes, they do take those reductions and those things like that now. And the worst part is they also do it, at least some companies, they don't tell you that it's coming, or they do it retroactively. Oh, yeah, we paid you 3 months ago, but we forgot to take this money out, so now we're going to do it this paycheck, and you're not really going to get anything.
Oops. Amy, is there anger or animosity among a lot of runners about these issues that have cropped up when the economy went south?
No, it happens to everybody. I mean, a lot of people lost their jobs. A lot of people are out of work, and you know, we're lucky to be able to get paid to run around a track or run on the road. And not sit in a cubicle. So, you know, we're lucky in a way that a lot of us still kept our contracts and kept our jobs through the bad economy and, you know, got supported through the Olympics or the World Championships. You know, and it's just the way the business is. I mean, that's how it's run. That's how it's always been run. But I think there could be better ways, and I think there could be other ways.
So, Amy, what do you think the upshot of this is? If shoe companies are getting more selective, or if they're cutting runners, or if it's just a volatile way to make a living, does this affect the structure of the sport? Are the U.S. elite ranks less deep than they ought to be, or do you see a lot of very talented runners who are just not even giving it a shot to develop?
I think so, especially on the women's side. You really don't peak until you're probably 26 to 30. So there's quite a few years in there that you may not be, you know, one of the top six or one of the top five in the U.S. for a while. You may not even be in the top 10 when you first come out. But you need those years to be able to develop. And if you don't have, you know, as I say, a livable wage, then you can't focus on what you need to focus on and train the way you need to train to keep progressing in the sport. And I think it's the way that they're cutting back, and all of them are cutting back, and they always do after the Olympics. It's nothing new. They've always cut back the year after the Olympics. The problem was is they already were signing less people to begin with. So when you cut back even more, when you're probably signing less, and it's not always the running department's fault. Let's say Nike or Adidas or Reebok, from the top down, they're saying, hey, we're cutting all budgets. So, you know, maybe the running department got their budget slashed by a quarter or a third, and, you know, that came from the top. So now they have less money to give, and, you know, it's not like they didn't want to. I think they'd probably like to have more athletes, but they just can't.
So, Amy, what do you think can be done to improve the business model for professional runners?
You know, that's really hard because the uniform rule with only being allowed to have so many, you know, so many logos. And I know they changed the rule in, you know, non-IAAF, non-championships. You can wear a few more logos now. But the problem is people that want to pay bigger amounts, that's where they want the logos. They want the logos at those events. But I would say, you know, there's other ways that you can use the athlete. Let's say if a big corporation decides, you know what, I want to sponsor this athlete or I want to sponsor this group. You know, maybe you can't put your logo on them as big as you want, but have them come into your company and do fitness programs. Have them speak to different groups. Have them go, you know, pay them to go put on a program for a Boys and Girls Club or, you know, speak to Girl Scouts and Boy Scouts. That way you're supporting the athlete, you're giving back to the community, and you look good. The athlete is representing you, and they're representing healthy living, and you know, it looks like you're giving back to the community and supporting an aspiring Olympian. I think that's a win-win.
I think getting the corporations involved would definitely help, and it seemed in researching this a bit, it seemed that's what some of the other major sports leagues have been able to do, and the track is maybe behind it.
Yeah. Well, I think we've kind of always limited ourselves, or sometimes didn't get as creative as we probably should, because it's just the status quo, and it's hard sometimes to get out of that, get out of the box.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think, Amy, that there's any way that the events themselves can be promoted better? In other words, not relying as much on the governing bodies like the USATF. Do you think? I mean, obviously the New York Roadrunners has gotten involved and promoted some races in addition to the New York Marathon that are, in a way, increasing the pie for elite runners with a 5K before the New York Marathon or the New York City Half, which didn't exist even 8 years ago. I mean, is that a positive trend when it's other organizations starting and promoting events?
Oh, it is. That's what we need. We need other corporations and events stepping in. I should know this, but the grocery store chain that stepped in and took over Drake, or sponsoring Drake Relays, they put a lot of influx of cash in and to help. And trust me, the athletes are like, okay, well, we'll go where the money is, and they're probably going to get a lot better athletes because they're willing to offer that. So when corporations step in and do that, it really helps. And they can, again, I know sometimes it's hard to get athletes to do things before competitions, and coaches always want them home right after. But we sometimes need to give back a little bit too. We are no longer in a position to say, pay me all this money just to wear your logo and I'm not going to do anything else. Even in our shoe, even in our shoe contracts, we have so many appearances we have to do every year. So, it's a give and take, and we need to give a little more sometimes.
Right. So tell us about your latest project, Amy, called Distance Divas Elite. I think you're in the process of setting it up, and it may take some time, but how did you come up with the idea and explain how it works?
So it's actually an idea I've had since 2000. I graduated from college, and my husband and I were married, and, there was a couple groups back then, not as many there as there are now, and one of the groups wanted him to join, and one of the groups wanted me to join, but there wasn't just one group that we both could go to at the same time, so we were kind of in this dilemma, what do we do? Well, we had this foundation in my hometown that kind of agreed to take me on if I moved back home, so I moved back home to Kendallville, and we actually set up a group at that point. We had a couple girls, I had my college teammate, Tracy Robertson, now it's Tracy Robertson Frack. We had Johanna Olsen, who actually, she just passed away from cancer this year, a brain tumor. And then we had Monica Hostetler, and we have one more that came in and out. But the foundation provided housing for us, and then they were going to fund kids programs that we were going to do. We were going to go into schools and do a program called Track is for Everybody, meaning track and field has an event for every body type out there. And we were going to go in and do these in schools, and the foundation was going to pay us to do the program, mostly in the off season when we would just be doing base training or easier training. And it was going to, we thought we had it all set up, and then 9/11 hit, and the foundation couldn't give us the funding anymore. They were still providing us with the housing, but the funding fell through with the foundation. So we were kind of left with, these girls living with us in training, and, I had promised them support because the foundation had promised us support. I didn't want to go back on my word, so I pretty much gave everything I had to support the girls through that. And then that lasted, till beginning of 2004. And at that point, I decided, I wanted to really try for the Olympics, and I just needed to focus and get away and do my own thing. So we ended up leaving Indiana and trying to focus on my running from that point on. So I want to revisit that again, and I want to try to do the programs in a women's group. Probably this time I won't promise more than I already have that I can give them. I've learned that lesson. But again, it's about foundations and corporations sponsoring the events, and the athletes representing the corporations to do these, to do the school programs. And it takes care of a lot of things. It helps the athlete with money and training costs. It puts the corporation's name out in the community. You are getting kids excited about track and field and getting moving, so it's helped with childhood obesity, nutrition, and healthy lifestyles. And hopefully you're creating track and field fans for life. And hopefully you're creating fans for those athletes that go in and do the program. There's a lot of positives coming out of the program if you can just get off the ground.
Yeah, okay. It sounds great. How many people have you enlisted? How many women have you got in the group so far?
Well, that's the thing. As I said before, I made that mistake in 2001. So I am in the process of doing the 501c3, setting up the foundation, because when I went and applied for grants, they only really give grants to people with 501c3. So I have to go back and do the 501c3, set up the nonprofit status. And then I need to go and get the funding before I can bring in the girls.
Got it.
I have certain limits of how much money I need, and I'm hoping for multiple year sponsorship. I know how much money I've gone over the budget a million times. I know how much I need before I can bring in so many girls. It's going to start off really small because I want to do it right. And the other thing, the programs aren't going to be the only source of income for the group and the girls. I'm hoping to continue with Distance Divas Elite will be the name of the girls group, but there's also Distance Divas, which is a women's recreational training group for people that want to run their first 5K or, you know, break 3 hours or 4 hours in the marathon, it's pretty much for everybody. And I'm going to have the Distance Divas Elite will take turns coaching these women, and then we'll also do cross country camp in the summer, which I had for years, and I put it on hiatus the last couple of years. We're going to do a lot of different things. Some of them I've already done, like the camp. I've started the recreational group here, so I know kind of how that's going to work. It's all going to be very slow, but I'm hoping by the end of this year, or middle of 2014, I can have at least some girls that I'm helping to get to the next level.
It sounds like what you're doing, and hopefully you'll be successful in bridging, the enormous participation boom that's going on with running and all of the work that's done, especially with children as well, in terms of fitness, which is, huge, and melding that with the elite running scene and the fact that the conundrum is that the running as a spectator sport or as a fan sport is not anywhere near that, but you're sort of setting up links between the participation boom and the elite runners, and I just really hope that it pays dividends.
I hope so too. The thing, it's almost kind of sad that the participation numbers have risen, but prize money and the support of the athletes running those races really has not risen, to say the least. I've been interviewing a lot of these women, and they were telling me how much money they were making in the 80s road racing, and I don't think we're anywhere near that.
Interesting.
What they're making. But I will say that USATF is trying to step up, and they have increased prize money for outdoors for this year, which they say, it hasn't been in, it was last time it was increased in 1998, but I think it was a lot longer than that.
I saw that they raised it, and it had been, 10 years or 14 years at least since they had raised it before.
The thing is, it's still only $7,000 to win. And granted, we have a lot of events in track and field. But most of the athletes, for a lot of us, actually, that would, pay for a couple months of training, travel, and whatever. So that would be great.
Right.
But it's still, as you said, it still drops off very fast.
Now, Amy, before we shift into talking about your career, which we want to do because Greg and I are just in awe of what you've accomplished, I want to ask you one more thing. If you take an athlete like Alicia Montano or Chris Sawinski, who both set U.S. records at Millroads on the indoor track, neither of them are sponsored. So knowing what you've known through all of your contract negotiations, what advice would you give them as far as getting paid to run?
You can try to be really creative and go out and try to get corporations to sponsor you, which I would really, try to do. The agents right now, they've kind of been in this box, and a lot of them don't know how, haven't really gotten out, or they don't know how to get out. But I can tell you it is hard to approach a corporation and ask for sponsorship because a lot of them have never done that. They have never been in that arena. They don't know how. You tell them you can run it through your advertising budget, your PR budget, whatever, and they just kind of look at you like you're crazy. But I know corporations do that. There's billboards. There used to be phone book advertising, things like that. So people have the budget, and I know the economy's been bad, but it's starting to come back, and there is more money in those areas. But you just have to be creative. You have to go in, and you have to show them what they can do and what you can do in return.
Right. So you would advise them to not focus solely on the shoe companies, but rather, sort of perhaps start a new way of getting paid as a runner, which is to get corporate sponsorship beyond the shoe companies.
Well, I mean, paying for your own shoes and apparel is very expensive. So if you could do that, and you could still go through the shoe company route. You know, if I had to do it all over again, I would go to the shoe company and get, a very small monthly stipend, enough to kind of cover the bases, and have that be steady throughout my entire career that I sign with them. That money that they give me every month can't be changed. It can't be taken away. It can't be increased. It just stays the same. But what can happen is the bonuses that you could earn, I think those should be bigger. I think they should be more. I think they should be more attainable. And have the shoe company or the agent sit down and say, okay, if this person had a stellar year and they, went above and beyond what they thought we could do, this is how much money they would earn. And set the bonuses up like that. Go backwards. Go, okay, if they did A, B, and C, we pay them this much. And so they just have to work backwards from what they think you would do.
Right. So perhaps better negotiating on behalf of the agents for the runners.
I mean, it's eat what you kill. But if you have a steady base that does not change, and I emphasize does not change, then it's so much easier and less stressful for the athlete to know that they have this steady base that's not going to change.
Now, I know that Nike wouldn't want you wearing an Adidas top or something. There must be some exclusivity in the shoe contracts or apparel contracts, but it would be possible to have both the shoe contract and support from other non-apparel companies, I imagine.
Right. The contracts state that you can't wear anything competing. For example, when I was with Adidas and they came out with the perfume that was actually in there, which I was like, are you going to sniff everybody? And then everybody came out with sunglasses, so you couldn't get another sunglass contract. Everybody came out with watches, so you couldn't get a watch. It's almost like they were coming out with every single product that you could put on your body so that you couldn't go out and get any other sponsorship, right?
And then Lauren Fleshman put a tattoo on her shoulders, and they said, no, you can't do that.
Yeah, and so that was interesting as well. So, yeah, there's a lot of exclusivity with what you can and can't do, but again, if you go out and do corporations that aren't apparel-based, that, aren't whatever. And, what I do with Nike sometimes is I bought plain Nike T-shirts, and if somebody wanted me to go do something, I had their logo or their whatever printed on a plain Nike T-shirt. I was still in Nike, but it had the corporation's name on it, or it had the different things, that I was going to do on it. So, but it was still Nike.
Right. Now, sort of as a segue then to talking about your career, you trained with Alberto Salazar and his Nike project, and as an incentive to sign with Nike, was it running with Alberto that did it, or?
I was at a crossroads in my career. I had fallen and had bursitis in my hip, and then I broke my ankle running in the woods, so I had not really raced in about 6 or 8 months, and I decided I needed to make a big change, and I actually called Coach Gags. Coach Gagliano, and he said, Amy, I don't have any 5K girls, but why don't you try Alberto, because I know Kara needs a training partner. So I called Kara, because we've been racing against each other since we were about 12, and she gave me Alberto's information, and, I called Alberto, he had no idea who I was, didn't know anything about me, which was probably fine, and he called Kara, and Kara said, I'd like her, and he went to Cap, and Cap said, I liked her racing style in college, she's a front runner, she's tenacious, let's give her a shot, and let's see what she can do. So I was pretty much signed up as Kara's training partner, which was fine. And, you know, because I was about proving what I could do and, you know, eat what you feel mentality. So, yeah, so I just went from there. And it was the first time in my career that I wasn't working two jobs. I could train twice a day. I could take a nap. I had weekly massage. I had weekly chiropractor. I didn't have to pay for those things, whereas before I did. So it was a lot of resources all of a sudden. And 18 months later, I made the Olympic team. So, you know, sometimes it's just about getting the resources to the right people.
Which is a perfect segue to what we wanted to talk about was the famous race, the 2008 Olympic trials, when you qualified for the team by 1.4 seconds. You've probably told the story many times, but can you take us through the last few laps and what that felt like? And also maybe, and was there a period during that race where you had substantial doubts about your ability to make that A standard and make the team?
You know, I had tried that race a couple times, and I ran 302, 301. You know, I just could not get under there. But I'm a big meet competitor. You know, going to those meets with, you know, 20 people in the stands really wasn't going to help me get to the next level in racing. And with Hayward, I didn't go into the stadium before. I didn't want to see it, so that when I came out underneath, it was amazing. You know, it was the last event on the track, and the stands were packed and loud, and it was amazing. And we, you know, the race plan was pretty much, we knew that, you know, Shalane and Kara were going to take it, and I was just going to hang on for as long as I possibly could and try to get the standard. You know, I think there's probably only about four people that believed I was going to do it. My husband and my parents and actually my chiropractor, they knew and they believed that I was going to get it. So we're running and I knew what I had to run, you know, to hit the time standard. And every time I came around, I kept tapping my watch and being, Alberto, it's too slow. I need to go. I need to go. And I even yelled at him once. I'm like, I need to go. he came over and told Andrew my husband, not to tell me to go because he wanted to control the race. So my husband finally just got angry and just screamed, you know, if you don't go now, you're not going to make it. So that's when I took the lead. I took the lead in the race for a while and got it back on pace. And then I guess the girls decided they wanted to go at it. So they took off. And I didn't go with them, and I don't know why I didn't. And then I had to start picking it up. And I knew with 600 meters to go, I think I had to run, I don't know, 140 or 142 or something like that. And like the week before, we had just done this amazing workout, 600 breakdown, and I ran the 600 and 139 in that workout. And so I put my head down and said to myself, you did this last week, you know, you can do this now. And I know I negative splitted the race, and I think I closed in probably a 67 or something, and I just put my head down and went, and I crossed the line, and I looked up, and they had stopped everything when Shalane crossed the line, and I had no idea what my time was. I had no clue, and so I'm laying on the track. I wasn't tired. I was emotionally drained because I didn't know if this was going to be the best night of my life or the worst night, because I had no idea what I just ran, and I was laying there until they put my time up, and I went from the biggest low to the biggest high in about 2 seconds because I knew then that I'd made the team and the last 18 months had been more than worth it.
It was a very savvy crowd at Hayward, right? They all knew what had just happened, right? So they responded.
Yeah.
For you.
Well, the funniest part was, well, they stopped the clock so nobody knew unless they have their watch going.
Right.
You know, so some people knew, some people didn't, and they tried to hand me the American flag. Well, they were giving the top three always the American flag, but whether you made it or not. And I really didn't want to take it until I knew that I'd made the team. You know, and then it was chaos from that point on. But it was funny, if you watch the NBC footage, they keep talking about Katie McGregor because Katie McGregor had the standard and she was only running for fourth because she knew that I had tried to get the standard two or three other times and I didn't get it. So Katie was convinced that I was going to miss the standard and she was just going to get to go no matter what. And so Katie didn't race. Yeah, Katie, she didn't race. She just ran for fourth because she knew, she thought I would never get the time and I would never go. Yeah.
Amazing.
I guess she probably has some regrets.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. And I don't know. For me, if I had the standard and didn't race for it, I would kind of feel like, you know, I just got handed something I didn't deserve. I think you need to go and race and earn it. I mean, I know we have one of the hardest teams to make, because you have to be ready and you have to be on that day. It's one day out of 356 days a year. If you wake up with a cold or you roll your ankle or fall down the stairs, I mean, an entire 4 years of training just went down the drain for just an accident or a cold. I mean, it is rough. It is a very rough way to make or break being an Olympian.
What did Alberto tell you after that race? Did he sort of say, I told you so, you know, it's good that you waited to go, or did you give him a piece of your mind, so you should have let me go earlier?
You know, I've never actually told anybody what he told me.
We can break some news here on the cloud.
Yeah, why not? You know what? After the race, Alberto, my coach, told me that because I took the lead and because I made the Olympic team, that I cost Kara the win in that race. And then he didn't talk to me for 2 weeks.
Wow.
Yep.
Cost Kara the win in that race.
Yep, I cost Kara the win in that race. And he told me the next day that I shouldn't have any contact with Kara because I was too much of a distraction and he didn't want me getting in the way of her losing the 5K.
That's not what we were expecting when we asked what Alberto told you after that race. It's quite remarkable.
Yep. There you go.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, did he get over it?
Yeah, he got over it after Beijing, and I was running really well in 2009.
Exactly. You really were on a roll in 2009, and in fact, you were smashing your time from that Olympic trials by something like 20-something seconds in the U.S. championships, and then even faster at Worlds. We were going to ask you about that amazing race against Shalane Flanagan in the 2009 U.S. championships, and we'll put videos for these on the show notes. But you had the back and forth with Shalane at 2009. It's very rare to see someone passed and then pass someone back, especially on the outside on the curve at the end of that 10,000. So how does that race rank among your all-time favorites? How do you even choose?
That one and Worlds are my two favorite races. I was incredibly fit at that point. And granted, Shalane was having, you know, an off year, but I was incredibly fit and ready to race. And Shalane and I had agreed to kind of swap every other 800.
Yeah.
And she threw down an 800 and went really fast. And she didn't pull out to let me take the next lead. And I verbally said, hey, you know, I can take this next 8. And I think it caught her off guard because I think she thought she was going to drop me with whatever she just threw down for that 8, but I was fine. And so she let me take the lead, and she just kind of waited until she wanted to make her move. And then I made a move, and she made another move. And I think I ended up making 3 moves on Shalane, and that's kind of the MO sometimes with certain athletes. You know how many moves you have to make on them kind of drop them. And honestly, it was, I think I closed in a 67, so I don't think my last lap was any faster than the year before, but it was just the back and forth between us. And I love that Shalane afterwards, she gives me a hug and she's like, you know, I didn't think you had that speed. And it was just really funny. We had a good time. It was a good laugh about that one.
Just as a side note, Brent and I both run sort of in the middle or back of the pack for Central Park Track Club, and there's a runner that gets lapped by both of you. I think maybe she'd been lapped a couple of times, but on the last stretch, maybe 50 meters from the finish, she may have gotten in the way just a little bit. It looks like you would have won anyway because you really had a lot of power on the back stretch, but she kind of slowed up Shalane a little bit. I think there were a lot of lapped runners that were getting in the way a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, there always is, and you have to, you just know that in the 10K. But I think some events, maybe like Worlds, I think they put the lap runners in lane two sometimes. Sometimes they don't. It just depends. I mean, if you run the 10K long enough, you've been there, done that.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned Shalane didn't think you had that finishing speed. And it's interesting, I've looked at your all-time best times, and I think, man, you can run a fantastic 5K and 10K coming off of a PR in the mile of 4:37, which is faster than my mile PR, but it seems like you can really keep a great pace. Now, just to bring Alberto into it one more time, he's gotten a lot of credit for helping Galen Rupp get his finishing kick down to really increase his speed. Did you do a lot of speed-specific work with Alberto to help hammer that final quarter down?
No, we did, and, you know, I know it sounds like, you know, I can be angry at Alberto, but he did a lot of great things for me. I mean, I did make the Olympic team. He gave me all the resources that I needed to be great. And, you know, he taught me how to work hard, and he taught me what it took to be on the elite international level. And I am very grateful for that, and I am very grateful for Nike for what they did. And Alberto, he did. We worked speed. We did a lot of 200s. We did 200 hills. We 600 breakdowns, 300 repeats, things like that. And probably the biggest difference was I was always chasing Kara and trying to close the gap. And I think I was always just trying to keep up, which helped me, run a lot faster. Because my husband had been my training partner and coach for a long time, but there's not that competitiveness with your husband sometimes in workouts as there is a female and a training partner. So I think having Kara there and trying to close the gap with her really helped with my speed and my kick.
Now, Shalane was training with another group. Who was a greater rival for you, do you think?
Was it
Kara or Shalane?
They both were. I only beat each of them a couple times, so
mm-hmm.
they've definitely beat me a heck of a lot more times than I beat them. So it was always for me closing the gap and trying to be as strong and as fast as they were.
Mm-hmm. Now, rewinding just one more time, your 2008 Olympic trials race, the fourth place finisher, you said was just assuming that you were not going to make the standard. And if you're watching the 5,000 final at last year's trials, Julia Lucas, who could have sort of sat and prevented other runners or tried to prevent other runners from reaching that standard, didn't do that. She went for it. And on the flip side, Kim Conley really came through. And we're wondering whether, A, you were watching that race, and B, you know, what you were thinking or feeling at the time.
It's actually the only race I went and watched at Eugene last year. I just emotionally and mentally couldn't watch any of the other events, but I went and watched that one. And it was heartbreaking, but yet exciting at the same time, because I had been in Eugene training with the OTC, or trying to train, but I'd been injured. And I had seen Julia train, all spring and in the whole season, and I knew how hard she was working. And to see her just the last few steps not have anything to give, and then Conley coming and just running for her goal and running for her dream, it was both sad and exciting at the same time. It was hard to watch, because you just knew that the one dream was died, and then but Kim's was just raring and ready to go.
Right. Did you put yourself in the position of either the runners? Did you think, Conley's doing what I did, or was it not like that?
No, I think it was definitely like that. I mean, making the team by such a little margin, and
mm-hmm.
you have to go into the race believing that you can do that and that it's definitely possible. If not, you're never gonna give it your all and try and put yourself on the edge like you need to.
Now, Amy, we talked about in intro how you've run as long as you've run a half marathon quite well in 110, and you're the 15K U.S. champ. Do you have plans, injuries permitting, do you have plans to take on the marathon at some point soon?
You know, I wanted everybody has plans. My long range plan was to run a marathon in the fall of 2012. Because if you would have asked me in 2009 if I'd be injured the next 3 years, I would have been like, yeah, right, because I was on top of the world. Every time I stepped on the track, I was running a PR or winning, and it just felt like that could last forever. You'd almost feel invincible at that time. And then, injuries come and you get sidetracked. So I kept thinking, okay, well, rehab and do this and rehab and do that. But, I've had two Achilles surgeries, nerve damage in my ankle, and then now I have kind of a torn hamstring and tendinopathy and stuff in my hip that has been here since September. So, I think this injury might be the one that just ends it all. So I'm not going to say I'm retiring, but I'm going to say that I don't know if I'll ever really compete on the elite level again. So I don't know. I mean, I will do a marathon before I die, either as competitively or for fun. if I have to walk one when I'm 80, whatever. I will do one before I die. So yeah, that's kind of where I'm at.
Mm-hmm. Well, you certainly have time when you think about there are runners, considerably older than you. I mean, you just need to catch a break with your health. I think Dina Castro went to Arkansas as well, and she's 5 years older than you, right? So.
Yep. Yeah, Dina, Dina had an amazing class at Arkansas, and they all graduated right when I was coming in, so I didn't really get to be with any of them. And it was really amazing, the things that they did before I got there. Yeah, and Dina's, 5 years older than I am, and all the women that I'm interviewing for the RRCA, a lot of them ran the first Olympics in 1984 in, their late 30s, and they were running 2:30 and, in not with the training and, goos and all that fun stuff that we have now. So I definitely think if I want to get back and my health will agree with me, that maybe I can. But right now, honestly, my goal is just to be able to sit for more than 10 minutes without pain. I have pretty simple goals right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that you have an incredibly healthy perspective for a runner. I was reading in your journal online, you had the a quote, after accomplishing every dream I had for the past 25 years, I knew I would eventually have a dream that would not happen. And I thought, that is very wise. That betrays a wisdom beyond your years, I think, that it hasn't stopped you from dreaming either. But it's a very realistic look, and I think it reflects some, that you're thankful for what you have accomplished, and that's a great deal in running. Let's shift to a murkier topic, that being performance-enhancing drugs. We've discussed this on the show. We interviewed a gentleman who organizes races and is advocating drug testing among amateurs, partly because the problem is so bad. It's certainly a hot topic in the news and in distance running. So how rampant, from your perspective as an athlete, do you think ped use is in track and in road racing?
I know when I was road racing, it was kind of pretty obvious who was using drugs and who wasn't, because those that could bounce back and race weekend after weekend after weekend and just keep winning, those are the kind of people that were using drugs. And then some people that I could beat in college and, they couldn't break 34 minutes on the track, they were now beating me on the road, 2 years later. It's like, not quite sure that's quite natural. But, in track and field, I don't know. I mean, we can get randomly drug tested and get drug tested at all the events, and funny enough, and as of April 1st, I will be off the random drug testing list for the first time in I don't know how long, but I will no longer have to have a sign on my front door saying, USADA and WADA, please ring both doorbells so I can hear it in my bedroom. I can take that off my front door as of Monday. because, we put up, two doorbells, so you can always hear it wherever you are in the house, and I've had that sign and that secondary doorbell forever, and you're always testing it to make sure it works.
Now, certainly, it sounds like there was certainly a lot of suspicion. Do you think that a lot of the athletes were beating the tests, or that they were participating in events that were not tested?
With the road racing, they weren't testing. When I first started road racing, which is like 2001 to 2006, I was road racing a lot. I don't know if I was ever drug tested on the roads, honestly. Maybe like once or twice. So there wasn't much drug testing going on then. You know, I definitely think our sport has a lot of drug use. I've never seen it, and I've never been asked. I know other athletes that have been asked about it and asked if they want to. You know, I've asked, you know, field event people, and they said, yeah, I mean, they know people that are. And, you know, it's just interesting that our sport has to be like that. I mean, for me, I would never want to jeopardize being able to live as long as I can, because I don't think anybody knows what the drugs will do to them long term. And I'd rather not test it and find out. Because everybody in my family's lived really long, you know, my grandpa was 104 when he died, things like that. So, you know, I want to continue the longevity of the family. I don't know, drug use is, the whole Lance Armstrong thing really got me thinking, because with the whole microdosing, more people could be using drugs than I ever thought if they were microdosing. And I used to think that drugs were out of the price range for people, but then, you know, Christian Hayes ended up using EPO, and I just thought, you know, he doesn't make the $100,000 that some of the other athletes make, and he's affording EPO, so that also changed my mind about how many people could be using drugs, because I guess not as expensive as I thought, and then now with microdosing, which I guess supposedly maybe is undetectable, but, you know, long-term use, it increases performance over a long time if you stick with it. So at least that's, you know, what they got from the Lance Armstrong stuff. So I don't know. I mean, I think there's probably more people than I would guess.
Our previous guest had talked about how there were drug busts among bikers and runners in events where there really was no prize money to speak of. It was just for their own personal vanity. So it really proliferates throughout.
Wow.
And it ties back to our topic of the economics of the sport, because if you think about the steep pyramid, I mean, if you're, you know, out, you know, in the second 10 and the 15th in the U.S. in a particular event, you're not making much. But if you advance 10 spots, you all of a sudden have a very viable career. If you drop 10 spots, you have to get a job like Brent and I. So you can understand the incentives in the economics.
You definitely can. And, you know, part of me, you know, trying to get back, part of me is like, you know, the only way that I would have to be motivated to come back is just to accomplish my goals, because with drug use, you just don't know. You just don't know, like, who you're competing against is clean or not. And, you know, me getting sixth in 2009 at Worlds, I was excited. But then again, I didn't really race, I don't think, as well as I could have. So I think you just have to have your own goals and go for those. And, you know, if money and places and time come with it, that's awesome. But you have to be happy with what you can do in yourself.
Right.
You mentioned, you know, the Worlds, you came in sixth in Worlds, and that was your PR, right, 31:13 in the 10,000?
Yep.
And you also mentioned that the race, the Olympic trials race, there was a moment in each race where you didn't go, and then after the race you thought, maybe I should have gone, right?
Yeah.
Now, was there a race in your career where you had that same moment, but you did go, where you did go with those racing out of you?
Yeah, I did a couple times. There was, like, NCAA Cross, I think 2000? I got second. I went with the lead pack, and I ended up getting second. And then my first indoor title, Terry Tollefson and I broke away. I went with her with that. I'd been second so many times, I wanted to win, and my mantra was, I'm going to win, I'm not going to be second anymore.
So you had a similar doubt in those races, but you overrode the doubt with...
Yeah.
Got it.
And honestly, the 2009 World Champs, the 3K to go, and the top five broke away, and honestly, I looked at the five that were with me, and I said, I can beat all these girls I'm with. I am happy with six. And I wish I wouldn't have said that to myself. I wish I would have tried to go with them. But, you know, they closed that last 3K faster than my PR. So, it would have been brutal, to say the least.
Mm-hmm. It's tough at those ranks. That's tough.
Yeah.
But sixth in the world is not too shabby.
I was excited about that. You know, I had my first goal was just to make the Olympic team. And after that, my goal was I wanted to break 15 in the 5K. I wanted to break 31 minutes in the 10K. And then after making the Olympics, I said I want to be in the top 10 in the world. So, you know, I broke 15 in the 5, and I was 6th in the world when I made the Olympics. So, you know, I told my husband the other day, I was like, I've probably accomplished 95% of this, all the things I've ever wanted to do. And I've rarely ever been told no. And now joining the workforce and doing things like this, I'm going to probably be told no a lot and probably not hit all my goals. So it's going to be a whole new world for me real soon.
Amy, Brent and I have a running goal of our own, and it's much, much more modest, but it's one we're, I guess, relentless about as well. We want to break 3 in the marathon, hence the name of the show, Cloud 259. If you could provide one training tip to us, maybe an unconventional one or whatever comes to mind, what would you tell us to do?
You know, I think a really important part of marathon training is when you do your long runs, every other week, part of that long run, there needs to be a tempo in the middle of it that's at marathon pace. So that you learn to do marathon pace kind of in the middle of your long run, you practice with your fluids, you just kind of practice what that pace is going to feel like. And then, you know, there's a lot of advice about, you know, do you run the full 26 before the marathon? Do you run farther than 26? You know, how far do you go? And I think that's kind of a personal preference, what you want to do and what's going to give you the most confidence. But I think you need to, whether you run the whole distance or not, you need to make sure that you stay aerobically active for the amount of time that you're actually going to be out there for the marathon.
Mm-hmm.
And how long should we be building up that marathon pace segment? Obviously, you can't do it, you know, for extended period of time at the beginning of the training, but what's the end goal for that?
I think the end goal would be to work up to being able to do it for about, probably like 12, maybe up to 12 miles of it in the middle of the long run.
Terrific.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Somewhat similar to a tip we had last week, but obviously good to have the confirmation there.
Yeah, actually, you're going a little easier on us than the other guy who is not an Olympian. if the Olympian says 12, then maybe I won't go 15. Maybe I'll go 12 instead.
You know, I was going to say 15, but I didn't want to scare you. I mean, I wanted to make it a little more friendly, but yeah, your first marathon, I would probably just say 12, and then the next.
Oh, it's not our first marathon. We're getting older. Our window is closing. We need to knock this out. So we're gonna. If you say 15, we're gonna do 15.
I would do 15, and you know you need to keep the distance up. You know. 2-3 weeks out, you know, don't really start tapering till about, you know, 2 weeks out.
Okay.
It's just going to be a little too flat. So, yeah.
Okay.
Thank you so much for your being so generous with your time and your insights on running as a business, but also going through your career highlights. It really has been a tremendous pleasure having you on. And
we'll see if I get any backlash about the Alberto thing. I've never said it, and I said I probably would never say it, but that's what happened.
All will be forgiven. Breaking news on the cloud. We love it.
I hope so. I hope he'll forgive me for saying that, but it hurt my feelings for a really long time.
I bet.
Well, we'll be in touch and as we progress towards our goal, and hopefully maybe we'll have you back sometime to discuss hopefully improvements and also your developments with this Distance Divas Elite.
and the TSA and the Track and Field Athlete Association. Hopefully that can be the new league of track and field that you were talking about earlier.
Exactly. Much more to discuss on the subject. So thanks again, Amy.
All right. Well, thank you guys. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Amy.
Yep, thank you.
Thank you. Thanks. Fantastic.
All right, Bren, so do you want to just talk briefly about how's your training going these days?
Well, after these interviews, it just takes me a moment to digest. And we've been told now twice that we need to do 15-mile at marathon pace. Going to have to get that on the calendar, Greg. All right, we're not there yet. My training's going all right. As I mentioned on the last show, I think my sister asked me what kind of shape I'm in, 1 to 10. I said 6.5. I'm trying to get up to 7 before my next race, which is the Scotland 10K coming up next weekend. So meant to do 3x1 mile today, but work got in the way, as you know. So I'm going to attempt to do that very early in the morning on Saturday. And that will be my last very hard workout before that 10K. So I'm hoping to get a PR in that. This is obviously not marathon training. It's just 10K training. I got a half marathon coming up in May. And then the real marathon training will start after that. So that's where we're at. I'm going to be going for PRs both at Scotland and at the Brooklyn Half. And yourself, Greg.
So I did the Hill of Death today, Brent.
Oh, yeah?
The workout routine that we came up with a few weeks ago, the treadmill run. It's pretty simple, but I think it's a very good short cardio workout when you're stressed for time. It's simply on a treadmill. It was a 1 mile warm up and then jack up the incline to 5% and just stay there for 20 minutes. And the goal is to run as far as you can or as fast as you can for those 20 minutes. And the catch is I can't lower the incline. Because in real life, if you're on Heartbreak Hill, you can't lower the incline. It's there. The only control you have is over how fast you run or how slow you run. So you can control the speed, but not the hill. And your heart rate goes up pretty early on, and it's kind of painful for that 20 minutes, but I think it's pure, in a sense, pure cardio training, kind of like speed training without the pounding of having to actually run that fast, because obviously you can't run as fast when you're on an incline for that long.
Now, did you measure your distance this time compared to the last time you did this workout?
Yeah, it was longer. It was 2.5 miles, which is exactly 8-minute pace, which doesn't sound great, and it's not great, but it's better than it was the last two times I did it. So progress each time, and I think the goal should be that we could both do this type of workout at our goal marathon pace, at that 2:59 pace for 20 minutes on a hill. Remember, the Heartbreak Hill is about 5%, so this is like Heartbreak Hill, but 4 or 5 times as long, because Heartbreak Hill is about a half a mile long.
Yeah, it's a tough one.
Yep.
It's a tough workout.
So I think we have the same sort of goal of getting sort of quicker at shorter distances before we take on the marathon in the fall.
Yeah. I think the marathon, you know, I'm going to take one real good whack at that 3-hour barrier at the New York City Marathon this fall. So my whole year's worth of training this year is focused towards that one race, which isn't to say I'm not going to enjoy other races or try to set other PRs. I think a difference in my training this year compared to prior years is I'm going to try to sustain a level of fitness through the summer that I've often let lag in the past. So that'll be the wrinkle.
All right, let's turn to the elite scene, shall we?
Yep.
Just quickly, we'll just do a very quick recap on the World Cross Country Championships, which were last weekend in Bydgoszcz, Poland. And the big surprise there, as many listeners probably already know, is the U.S. men's team finishing second and notably beating Kenya, which was a surprise, to say the least. Ethiopia won, U.S. second, Kenya third. Admittedly, it wasn't Kenya's big big stars. A lot of them were on the roads. But then again, it wasn't the top team that the U.S. could field. There were some great names. Chris Derrick is obviously one of the top runners. But Ben True was the top American. He came in at sixth place. Great run by him. In the cold, snow on the ground, muddy conditions. Ryan Vail 17th and Bobby Mack 19th. Now, one little factoid that we put up on the website on Cloud 259 were that if someone else, one of the bigger stars like Rupp or Dathan Ritzenhain or Meb had attended, if any of them had finished in the top seven, in other words, if they had stuck on Ben True's shoulder and either finished ahead of him or just behind him, then the U.S. would have won gold. They would have taken down Ethiopia, which would have been even more amazing.
Yeah, I think it's if Ritz had shown he instead of having done New York half, he had done the cross, he might have helped the U.S. get gold. So that's it's interesting, and I bet though that all the countries would say, well, if we had A, B, and C show up, then we would have done better. And that's an issue that I will get at on the soapbox when we get there.
All right, looking forward to that. Just a couple of other notes. The women finished fourth. Dina Castor ran, and she had run the L.A. Marathon just the week before. And now we have word that she's running a half marathon in New York in just 2 weeks. So she's really running a lot and a lot of distances, and it's quite amazing to see at the age of 40. She turned 40 on Valentine's Day. The other look ahead we have is for this weekend, there's the Stanford Invitational track meet. There are a lot of great runners, but I think the highlight from what I could tell was that the women's 10,000, where Kara Goucher and Shalane Flanagan are both running, and Jordan Hasse, the college star from Oregon. It's notable that Kara and Shalane are both running the Boston Marathon in just a few weeks, yet they're, I guess, doing a tune-up in Stanford and perhaps trying to get that A standard for the World Championships later in the U.S. Championships and then the World Championships later this summer.
Yeah, and Shalane also, she was on the list to run the cross in Poland, and she didn't. So I assume that her team has decided that the 10K on a track would be less detrimental to the legs in cross country a few weeks out from marathon. But we interviewed Amy Begley tonight, and it's interesting. If you look back at the race results from 2009, 2010, Amy was running right with or ahead of, Kara and Shalane. So it's, it's too bad that injuries have sidelined her, but that's the way it goes in track. You really can't take anything for granted, and there's a lot of turnaround at the top because of injuries.
And both Kara and Shalane have had their periods. Kara especially had a long period where she was injury prone and not able to run. So it happens to almost everyone.
That's right.
All right. So the next portion of the show is the library, and you've been heading to the library the last several weeks. I was accusing you of being better read than me. This time we're going to sort of do a tag team on a very well known book among the running obsessed. Called Once a Runner, and there was also
Again to Carthage was the sequel. Yeah.
And Parker, I'm sorry, is it John Parker? I forgot the first name.
It's John L. Parker Jr.
John L. Parker. So, many people have obviously read the first book. I actually hadn't. But it's a fictional book about a runner going to Southeastern University and chasing a 4-minute mile and chasing a lot of other things. But I guess what I wanted to ask you, Brent, is you were a high school runner and a college runner. I wasn't, but I was wondering if that was required reading. The book was written in 1978, and was that required reading among your teammates, among the circles of
running? I don't think I was. Though I ran cross country and track at Brighton High School and at Swarthmore College, I wasn't quite geeked out enough, or my teammates weren't quite geeked out enough, so that these books made the rounds. At least they never hit me. I think at Swarthmore, people were so worried about passing their classes in general that they might not have had time to sneak in Once a Runner.
Yeah.
So I actually didn't hear about it until after I graduated from college and here in New York.
Well, judging by some of the posts on or forums on letsrun.com and also all over the internet, there are a lot of websites that pick out quotes from the book. It seems like it's very prominent in the niche area of the running obsessed. It is to me. I mean, my takeaway is there are a lot of vivid, very accurate descriptions of running scenes, but also what it feels like to be running in a race. And I just wanted to pick out one of them here, and it kind of ties into our recent episode on pacing and optimal pacing and distributing your effort throughout the race. This is just sort of a broad description of what a runner is, and it goes like this. A runner is a miser, spending the pennies of his energy with great stinginess, constantly wanting to know how much he has spent and how much longer he will be expected to pay. He wants to be broke at precisely the moment he no longer needs his coin. And then
that's a nice way to put it. Bannister said at the end of his 4-minute mile that he felt like an exploded flashlight. So I think that's another way of saying it, but I like that. You basically want to be completely spent at the end.
One other quote.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
No, you've got another quote there, yeah.
Yeah, just one other quote really ties into a little bit to our discussion with Amy about having a moment of in any race where some doubt creeps in and you don't know whether to go or not. It's about the mile, and it's about the third lap of the mile, which can be the most painful because you're not near the end and the pain is really setting in. It goes like this. It was a long, cruel lap with no distinguishing feature save the fact that it had to be run. Every miler knows, in the way a sailor knows the middle of the ocean, that it is not the first lap, but the third that is farthest from the finish line. Races are won or lost here, records broken or forfeited to history, careers made or ended. The third lap was a microcosm, not of life, but of the bad times, the times to be gotten through, the no toys at Christmas, sitting at the bus station at midnight blues time to look back on and try to laugh about or just forget. The third lap was to be endured and endured and endured.
Bad times. Having run many mile races, I totally relate with that. I totally identify with that. And, you know, it's interesting, we talked to James Chu last time, and he was talking about how in a mile you want to take it out hard and then sort of get comfortable for a little bit and then kick hard. And his approach sort of surprised me because I thought, wait a minute, you can think about easing into your pace in the second and the third laps, not how they're torture. But, yeah, that third lap is tough.
And really, the third lap can be applied to almost any race, right? I mean, it's sort of similar to the wall or the stretches of a marathon before you're really anywhere close to the finish, but you're doubting yourself and just really feeling the pain. I think there's an equivalent. It's absolutely true in the mile, but I think it's true at other distances too.
Yeah, I'd say that the 2 mile. I did a 3200 on the track last year, and the first and the last laps were okay. And the 2 through 7 were very painful, so it was like an extended third lap. It's the middle of the race. I find in marathons, sort of the mile, 14 to 18 can be tough because you're still pretty far from the finish. It's the same kind of deal. But at any rate, I'll say about those books, there are nuggets like those, and there are other nuggets that are just fantastic. And there are also sections that aren't really about running at all. And it's interesting because I came to this book hearing that here was the book for runners. And I enjoyed it quite a bit because it was a lot better. It spoke to me far more directly than any fiction I had read about running before. And I really appreciated that. And I went out and got the sequel again to Carthage. And again, there were long stretches that weren't about running. But the parts that were about running were very satisfying, and again, to Carthage gets in a little bit on a runner's relationship with a non-runner, and I like that too, because you get Parker sort of established pretty well how, you know, a runner has a certain mindset where he doesn't think twice about running 10 miles into town and 10 miles, you know, back home, and for other people that can be a bit odd. Once a runner is about a mile race, ultimately, and again, to Carthage is about a marathon, ultimately. So these cover the bookends of distance running, as I like to think of it. And I'd say if anyone has read, or those who have read Once Runner, if you enjoyed it, I definitely would recommend Again to Carthage, because you get the same quality of writing about a marathon. Maybe not quite as high a percentage of the book has that quality writing, but it's there. Those nuggets are there, and they're certainly worth the parts that you may be less interested in. I spoke briefly with John Parker at a marathon expo a few years ago, and he noted that, you know, life is about more than running, which is partly why the books aren't running from page, you know, one to the very end. There's more to life than simply running. So he wasn't just writing these books for runners. He was writing these books for everybody. And once a runner really got sort of established cult status, I think in part because it was out of print, everyone was searching desperately for it, and you know, I think the secondary book market prices were pretty high. But it's in print now, and it's easy to find on Amazon. And I think, Again to Carthage was not released with quite the same fanfare, but it's still quality writing.
Do you happen to know when Again to Carthage came out? Was that just a few years ago?
Yeah, 2007. So Once a Runner, I think, was originally released in 1978, and Again to Carthage was just, I guess, 6 years ago now.
That's quite a span of time in between books.
Yeah.
29 years.
Yeah, it is. I suppose it. You know, you start with the mile, and then later in life, become more contemplative. Right about the marathon, I suppose. John L. Parker has written and contributed to other books in the interim, but. I think in this series, you know, there hasn't been a third one yet.
Very good. So let's head to your soapbox. I'm very interested to hear what you have to say about World Cross. You have an idea for it.
I have an idea. Yeah. All right, everyone, suspend your disbelief in what is possible. Here we go. The World Cross Country Championships in Poland last weekend received outsized attention from letsrun.com, and it was a gift to get such coverage from an event happening so far away and of so little significance to so many people. Cross country is close to the heart of the founder of Let's Run, as it is close to mine. I skipped a few winter and spring track seasons in high school and college, but I never missed a season of cross country. Autumn is by far the best season for running. In the hype around the race, a few odd threads emerged about this World Cross. One was that the IAAF had put the race in Poland again because the winter weather would strengthen its case to add cross-country to the Winter Olympics. And this seemed to me to be a bit of a stretch. Then Let's Run, in its enthusiasm for cross-country, suggested that if cross isn't added to the Winter Olympics, it should replace either the 5,000 meters or the 10,000-meter runs in the Summer Games. Now, enough of the tail wagging the dog here. Remember, rather than force running to fit the Olympics by jamming cross country into winter or replacing the deliciously suspenseful 5,000 or 10,000 meter races, the Olympics should be expanded to fit the running. Cross country belongs in the fall, thus we need a fall Olympics. You'll have no shortage of cities angling to win the opportunity to host the 2017 Games. Memo to all the governing bodies of Olympic sports, there's money to be made here. As long as seasons are integral to the Games, let's celebrate them in full. Put the marathon in the Spring Olympics, think Boston, in 2015. And while at it, put a few other road race events in there too. Add indoor track to the Winter Games with the snow sports, and keep outdoor track in the Summer Games with the beach sports. Allocate all the other sports in whatever season seems most fitting. Four seasons, four Olympics, one per year, each featuring the best distance runners on earth. At the very least, it should get Dathan Ritzenheim back in cross country.
Very nice. I love the idea. Anything else in this? Would basketball be moved to the spring, or would it stay in the winter? No, it's in the summer. I'm sorry. So what else?
I think basketball is miscast. You know,
yeah.
Each sport could choose its Olympics. You know, it's going to happen. That season will be celebrated once every 4 years.
Maybe they'd have room to keep wrestling, which got unceremoniously dumped just a month or two ago.
For sure. And you would have these, you know, you would have, it would solve a lot of problems. Some of the problems we were talking about earlier tonight with Amy Begley, you know, I think the runner's exposure and, you know, the competitions that the athletes, you know, the swimmers who are celebrated once every 4 years would get, well, I guess they'd still be celebrated once every 4 years, but perhaps you could have an open water swim in summer games, and then that pool stuff you could shift to the winter games. There are many ways to give you the pie. There are a lot of these sports that take several different forms. Divvy them up. I want it to be Galen Rupp in the cross country at the Olympics in the fall.
Yeah, you wouldn't have these weird off years, yeah, in running where there's no world championship and no Olympics like in 2014.
Yeah.
Terrific, Brent. No, that's a great idea. I'm on board. I'm sold.
Let's make it happen. All right, Greg, have we reached the end of the rope here?
I think we have. I think in the upcoming episodes we have, as we said, we'll be returning to the issue of the business of running. There's a lot more to be discussed there. I think in the near term we also have to do some previews of some upcoming important marathons. London and Boston are coming up just a few weeks, so we may tackle that in our next episode.
Well, I look forward to it, I guess, yeah. We've got those marathons to look forward to. We would like to thank Amy Begley one more time. She's off the call now, but she was calling in from Beaverton, Oregon, by the way. And it was a real honor and a thrill to have her on the show. For Greg, this is Bren Jones. For Greg Lemelstein, Bren Jones, I should say. Thank you so much for making it this far in the episode. And we'll see you next time. And please do check out our site, cloud259.com, where we will keep updating, even when we're not recording podcasts, on the latest and greatest news in track and field and distance running. Good night, everybody.